Chapter 13. Herbert Haggerty, head of the political section at the American Embassy in the Pakistani capital, Islamabad, woke up early on Wednesday, November 21st. At 7 a.m., as was his habit, he listened to the news on Voice of America. The broadcast made him uncomfortable. Items on Carter's dispatch of a naval task force to the Persian Gulf and on the seizure of the Grand Mosque were paired together, with emphasis given to Washington's threats of military action in the hostage standoff. A distracted listener, Haggerty thought, might conclude that the sacrilegious bloodshed in Mecca could have been a result of America's military moves. Relations between the United States and Pakistan were decidedly frosty at the time. The country's military dictator, General Muhammad Zia-ul-Haq, rode the region's wave of religious fervor and earlier that year had announced plans to establish an authentic Islamic order in Pakistan. As Zia canceled elections, he also began implementing Sharia-mandated punishments such as public floggings and amputations. These policies, combined with Zia's vigorous pursuit of nuclear weapons, provoked a retaliation by Washington. All American assistance and arms sales were suspended, and a flustered Zia started looking toward an Islamic alliance with his revolutionary neighbor, Iran. After all, both countries had called themselves Islamic republics, and Islam was the very reason for the existence of Pakistan, a predominantly Muslim part of former British India that had been partitioned off at a huge human cost 32 years earlier. In early November 1979, once the American embassy was captured in Tehran, Iranian diplomats threw daily bonfire parties on their own embassy lawn, brashly urging their Pakistani hosts to launch a similar assault. In the Pakistani media, America was now routinely portrayed as the enemy of the true faith. The Muslim, an Islamabad newspaper, that Wednesday morning published a special edition that, like the Voice of America newscast, combined reporting on Mecca events with news of Carter's dispatch of American troops. These, the Pakistani Daily charged, were two hostile actions against the Muslim world by the imperialists and their stooges. As Haggerty drove to work, the first radio reports on the violence in the Grand Mosque, a place most Pakistanis either visited or hoped to visit on Hajj, brought the nation's hectic metropolises to a standstill. Carnage in the heart of Islam seemed to cause anguish on a visceral, deeply personal level. People were shocked to hear the news over the radio, and many people broke down in tears. Shops had been closed down as a mark of people's indignation and resentment, a grave-voiced state radio anchorman told Pakistanis on Wednesday. News of seizure of Kaaba has sent waves of widespread resentment and grief throughout the country. Haggerty started his day at the embassy by penning an immediate cable that expressed to the State Department his concerns about the Voice of America report and warned of likely anti-American actions in Pakistan. Built at a cost of $21 million 6 years earlier, the American embassy to Pakistan occupied an elegant modern compound containing a club, a school, and housing blocks. It sat on the edge of Islamabad, overlooking a landscape of fat cows that grazed in well-watered green pastures. Both the ambassador and the deputy chief of mission were outside the building at about 11 a.m. when Haggerty, the most senior officer remaining indoors, received a phone call from the Australian envoy. The Australian embassy was located about halfway between the Americans and the city center. The Allies called in a warning. A crowd of about 500 youths, shouting anti-imperialist slogans, was heading Haggerty's way. For diplomats in Islamabad, this was not their first anti-American rally. Surrounded by a wall and guarded by a Pakistani detachment that had been tripled in size earlier that month, the Americans felt relatively secure. They were also protected by a small contingent of U.S. Marines, commanded by Master Sergeant Lloyd Miller, a tall, muscular 38-year-old from California. Once the demonstrators arrived, Haggerty dispatched a junior Urdu-speaking officer, David Welch, to meet them at the compound's outer gate. Usually, protesters would hand to the embassy staff a petition outlining whatever grudges they had with American policies and would be on their way after polite assurances that such grievances would be presented directly to President Carter forthwith. The same benign scenario seemed to be unfolding this morning. Welch returned to the chancery with the demonstrators' anti-American manifesto. The youths appeared to be largely leftists. "They're coming your way. I think they are satisfied, Haggerty replied to the Australian ambassador with relief. A few minutes later, the phone rang again. I hate to disappoint you, the Australian warned, but the bus that had passed us has turned around and is now heading toward you with several more buses from the university. Men clustering on roofs and hanging from the doors of these ramshackle red and blue buses, a much larger mob now rolled toward the diplomatic quarter. Dominated by Islamist firebrands from the capital's Qaidi Azam University campus, these young men, dressed in robes and traditional shalwar kameez, the matching suits of loose tunics and baggy cotton pants, seethed with uncontrollable rage. As Haggerty feared, a connection between events in Mecca and Carter's decisions had been made in their minds. Iranian revolutionaries, and before them, the likes of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, have long inundated the Islamic world with self-pitying propaganda that held Westerners, and in particular Jews, responsible for all the evils that have befallen the Muslims. In this paranoid worldview, the Americans and the Jews were eternally plotting to undermine Muslim interests and to sully the shrines of Islam. The statement by the Saudi Minister of the Interior that had aired on Pakistani radio Wednesday morning gave no clue about the identity of the mysterious deviators occupying the Kaaba. So, as Pakistanis learned that the House of God had been desecrated by gun-toting invaders, many instinctively blamed the usual suspects. Even well-educated, seemingly reasonable Muslim intellectuals quickly succumbed to outlandish conspiracy theories. The same happened 2 decades later when surprisingly large numbers of Muslims in Pakistan and elsewhere grew convinced that the September 11, 2001 outrage had really been a covert operation by the CIA and the Israeli Mossad. After hearing about the seizure of the Grand Mosque, one well-known Pakistani newspaper editor jumped to an instant conclusion. An American task force must have launched in Mecca an operation to take full control of the Persian Gulf region. Then he recalled the daring Israeli raid that had rescued hostages in Entebbe, Uganda 3 years earlier, and decided that the plot wouldn't be complete without the Jews. Entebbe is on everyone's mind, the editor explained to an American reporter hours later. People here believed for the last 2 or 3 years that Israel is planning such a stroke, to drop paratroopers on Mecca or Medina, or both. In the following days, it would be a subject of great debate within the Carter administration how precisely such rumors began, and whether Khomeini was responsible for the tragedies that ensued. One thing is clear. Iranian officials, as they awoke Wednesday morning and saw news reports coming out of Washington, did not appreciate being fingered by America, or Israel, as desecrators of the Grand Mosque. Assuming a posture of wounded innocence, Tehran's foreign ministry complained that day, Zionist and U.S. circles have tried to connect this act with Iran. The informed people of the world know that the enemies of the true progress and development of mankind use many such tricks. Then Radio Tehran broadcast a separate communique from Khomeini's office in Qom. Turning the tables, it accused the United States and Israel of orchestrating the despicable horrors in Mecca. It is not far-fetched to assume that this act has been perpetrated by the criminal American imperialism so that it can infiltrate the solid ranks of Muslims by such intrigues, Khomeini's office declared. It would not be far-fetched to assume that, as it has often indicated, Zionism intends to make the House of God vulnerable. A New York Times correspondent in Tehran reported hearing this incendiary broadcast at 8 a.m., which is 9:30 a.m. Pakistani time, well before any protests began in Islamabad. But the CIA's chief of covert action staff later informed the White House that, according to American radio monitors, Khomeini's statement was first aired early Wednesday afternoon, or 2 hours after Pakistani mobs first encircled the American embassy. Regardless of whether they had been influenced by Iranian radio, or, like the Pakistani newspaper editor, spontaneously blamed America, the militant youths who burst into Qaidi Azam University classrooms at about 10 a.m., disrupting lectures, seemed to nurture few doubts. American Jews, they announced, had just occupied Islam's Holy of Holies. For every true Muslim, revenge was a duty. When these demonstrators converged on the American diplomatic enclave, they were no longer interested in delivering petitions. The swelling new throng of protesters started out by burning an embassy vehicle that, with terrible timing, had just pulled up to the compound. In an initial altercation, a student named Asif was shot dead, most likely by police. After that, Pakistani troops who were supposed to maintain order vanished into the mob. Some even handed over their guns. Protest organizers shouted that the student, whose bloodied body lay sprawled on the ground, had been killed by Americans firing from inside the embassy. As a battering ram appeared by the wrought iron gates, embassy staff, realizing how defenseless they had become, rushed to lock up classified files. Master Sergeant Miller, a battle-hardened Vietnam War veteran, commanded a total of 6 Marines inside the embassy building. Some were at checkpoint number 1 in the main entrance lobby. One Marine was at checkpoint number 2, the back gate that opened into the cafeteria and the lower floor area where Pakistani staff worked. And one Marine, 19-year-old Corporal Steve Crowley from Long Island, was dispatched to observe events from the roof. "Death to American dogs! Avenge the sacrilege in Mecca!" The mob started to chant as the battering ram hit one of the brick columns that supported the compound's entry gate. With surprising ease, the column caved in. The way to the building was open. Then, all of a sudden, bullets started to fly. The Marines hadn't expected to find themselves in a gun battle and made easy targets. One of the very first shots felled Corporal Crowley, hitting him in the side of the face. He collapsed unconscious. Once inside the embassy grounds, Pakistani rioters headed to the motor pool area in the back of the building, pouring flammables and setting several dozen diplomats' vehicles alight. A new rumor electrified the mob. Supposedly, one of the students had been captured by the Americans and was allegedly being held prisoner inside. Attackers began to make firebombs out of cloth soaked with petrol and hurl the flaming missiles into the embassy windows. Some landed on the carpeted floor, igniting parts of the embassy itself. After racing down from the roof, Master Sergeant Miller dragged Crowley into the office of the embassy nurse, who desperately tried to revive the hemorrhaging Marine with an oxygen mask. The nurse's office sat next door to the embassy vault. Consisting of several rooms and a windowless steel box, the vault is where the most sensitive documents, coding devices, and communications equipment were kept. The vault had its own power generator, and its ceiling was connected via a hatch to the embassy roof, an escape route created for precisely this kind of emergency. As bullets whizzed by, shattering windows, Master Sergeant Miller, for the first of many times that day, asked for permission to use firearms to defend the embassy. The request was turned down. Instead, orders sounded. Everyone to the vault. Running through smoke-filled corridors, the Marines poked their heads into every room, making sure that everyone had heard the instructions. Trying to hold the attackers at bay, the Marines, not all of whom even had gas masks, then started to lob tear gas grenades into the crowds that massed by the back and front lobbies. A total of 137 people, American diplomats, Pakistani staff, and a few guests, including Marsha Granger, a visiting reporter from Time magazine, packed the vault by 2 p.m. 4 people were missing. Though herded out by the Marines, 3 Pakistani employees and 1 Spaniard, a builder working on the ambassador's residence, had changed their minds and returned to their offices, hoping to have a better shot at survival separately. With the embassy now on fire, the air in the vault became unbearably hot. Tear gas also filtered in, prompting bouts of retching. His request for authority to use firearms turned down again, Master Sergeant Miller pulled all his Marines from the lobby checkpoints and into the vault. At 2:23 p.m., a triumphant crowd ran amok through the embassy. Outside, as Pakistani soldiers looked on, demonstrators climbed up the flagpole and tore down the stars and stripes. Having torched the American flag, they hoisted up in its place the white Muslim crescent and star on the green Islamic background that make up the banner of Pakistan. The same white and green banner was being carried with pride at this very moment by troops accompanying General Zia on a 4-hour Meet the People tour of Rawalpindi, a large, chaotic city 10 miles south of the wide, empty boulevards of Pakistan's purpose-built capital. Moving at first in an open jeep and then on bicycle, the Pakistani dictator was showered with flower petals by women strategically positioned on balconies along his route. Whenever Zia stopped, aides handed out bags of rice, cash, and copies of the Quran. At a teeming Rawalpindi marketplace, Zia made a speech that was carried live on Pakistani radio and TV. haranguing his subjects about the need to become better Muslims, Zia promised to turn Pakistan into an impregnable fortress of Islam. Then he expressed his pain over an unfolding tragedy, the one in Mecca, not Islamabad. "The situation in Kaaba is extremely sad," the Pakistani leader said. "Muslims must pray to God Almighty to bestow His blessings and mercy on the Muslim world." Ever since the attack on the embassy began, hours before that speech, American officials had been trying to get Zia to intervene. From the vault, Haggerty, the most senior diplomat inside the embassy, was in permanent radio contact with Ambassador Arthur Hummel, who remained at home not far from the embassy and who kept calling the Pakistani Foreign Ministry, police, and army commanders. But lower-level Pakistani officials didn't budge, and Zia just wouldn't take the calls. Even President Carter, awakened by Secretary Vance at 4:13 a.m. with the news of the embassy siege, couldn't get a hold of the Pakistani leader on the first attempt. As many American diplomats in Islamabad concluded afterward, Zia, reluctant to alienate Islamic radicals among his supporters, had deliberately decided to let the embassy burn. The Pakistani army and police troops, who kept arriving in the diplomatic area throughout the day, behaved, in the words of an eyewitness report in Pakistan's Dawn newspaper the next morning, as silent spectators. Energized by the government's reluctance to protect Westerners in the country, rioters flooded the streets across Pakistan. In Rawalpindi, just as Zia visited town, mobs incinerated the Christian convent of Jesus and Mary and burned down the U.S. Information Center, a British library, and offices of American Express. The American Cultural Center was set ablaze in Lahore, and the American Consulate and Pan American Airlines offices attacked in Karachi. A Bank of America branch was gutted in Islamabad. Everywhere there was the same explanation. American institutions, declared a student leader in Lahore, had to be burned because the Holy Kaaba has been occupied by Americans and the Jews. Showing considerable personal courage, the West German ambassador, Ulrich Schesker, approached the blazing American embassy at about 3 p.m., trying to persuade the protesters to disperse. Nobody listened to him, and the crowds continued to grow, augmented by new buses arriving from Rawalpindi. The besieged diplomat's spirits were momentarily lifted once a Pakistani army helicopter appeared in the sky. The Americans first heard about its approach by radio. Haggerty even asked for snipers to be aboard. Soon the engine and the rotation of blades became audible inside the vault. For several long minutes, the chopper hovered low above the compound. Everyone expected it to land on the roof, if only to evacuate the wounded Marine. But after having a close look at the mayhem below, the Pakistani pilot banked to one side and just flew away. Protesters cheered. In the vault, a mood of depression set in. The trapped Americans realized that they were on their own, and that they might not live until the end of the day. Minutes later, Corporal Crowley bled to death. Afraid of further undermining morale, Haggerty kept this depressing piece of news secret. Via internal embassy phone, he was contacted by the three Pakistani employees and the Spaniard who remained on the second floor. Choking in the thick smoke, they said they could no longer hold out. Haggerty suggested they jump out the windows and into the crowd below. Because the embassy was set on a slope, that window was not too far from the ground. The four wore Pakistani shalwar kameez dress. If they were lucky, Haggerty reckoned, they could be mistaken for rioters. The Spaniard and one of the Pakistani employees listened to the advice and got away with a few bruises and a twisted ankle. The other Pakistanis were too scared to jump. They succumbed to the smoke and died of asphyxiation under their desks. Just before 4 p.m., attackers climbed onto the embassy roof and started banging on the hatch, trying to pry it open with crowbars. Language specialists among the diplomats noted that, according to the shouting that could be heard from the roof, these assailants were Urdu-speaking Pakistanis and Arabic-speaking foreigners. No Farsi-speaking Iranians appeared to be present. Angered by the sturdiness of the hatch, intruders began to unload volleys of fire into the ventilation shafts. As bullets zinged around the vault, the Marines finally received permission to use live ammunition, if needed. The part of the vault under the hatch was a separate room, and the air there seared the lungs, filled as it was with a particularly toxic combination of smoke and tear gas. Placed under Master Sergeant Miller's command, All Americans with weapons rotated on short stints to that spot, gun barrels pointed upward and ready to fire should the hatch give in. The Marine was surprised and somewhat alarmed by how many people in the embassy, unbeknownst to him, turned out to possess firearms because of their various undercover jobs. His biggest worry was that the attackers would pour gas down the air conditioning vents and then torch it, turning the vault into a crematorium oven. Trying to electrocute the Pakistanis on the roof, one enterprising CIA agent hooked up a live 400-volt cable to the vault's exposed metal. This, however, didn't work. "Do you have any hope for us?" a diplomat manning the radio, the vault's only connection with the outside world, shouted in despair. Because of the scorching heat, everyone now had to breathe through wet paper towels. As the fire ravaged lower floors of the embassy, the vault's steel floor turned into a giant frying pan. Only a wall-to-wall carpet provided a semblance of insulation. And at about 5:30 p.m., one corner of that carpet suddenly burst in flames. A scream of, "Fire in the vault!" broke the tense silence. Two blasts from a fire extinguisher were enough to put it out, for now. But the temperature just kept climbing, with tiles on the vault's inner surface loudly cracking from overheating. The trapped diplomats would be cooked alive if they remained in the vault much longer. Master Sergeant Miller, other armed Americans, and one Pakistani employee decided to make a run to the roof. Darkness had already fallen on Islamabad, and Canadian diplomats, who observed the drama from their compound across the road, radioed in to say that the crowds of protesters had begun to thin out. Groping their way through clouds of smoke and smoldering corridors, the Marines' advance party finally reached fresh air, weapons drawn and ready to fire. As Master Sergeant Miller stepped onto the roof, he saw the last of the Pakistani assailants climbing down a ladder. The rioters had had enough fun for the day and were now almost gone. It took several more minutes to open the hatch, which the attackers had tried to jam. One by one, the sooty, sweaty diplomats emerged under the resplendent starry skies. Then, protected by the Marines, they went down improvised ladders and onto the lawn. With everyone safely escorted out, Master Sergeant Miller climbed back to the vault. He returned, carrying over his shoulder the lifeless, blood-soaked body of Corporal Crowley. The young Marine was not the only American serviceman to die in Islamabad that Wednesday. As protesters rampaged through the embassy compound, they also ransacked staff apartments. In one of them, they found U.S. Army Warrant Officer Brian Ellis, a pilot for the American military mission in Pakistan. Ellis had a day off and was having a nap. They gunned him down and then set his body on fire. Two protesters were reported dead. Asif, the student shot by police early in the attack, and an employee of the local health department, identified by local newspapers as Mr. Ashik. Late at night, once Haggerty reached his home in another part of the diplomatic area, his son Devon, a high school senior, lurked behind the door. In his hands, the teenager clutched a baseball bat, ready to hit whatever Islamic revolutionaries would appear on the doorstep. The Pakistani government's monumental failure to help people trapped in the American embassy, all 137 of whom could have died in that vault, did not seem to cause any offense in Washington. To the contrary, President Carter and Secretary of State Vance rushed to publicly praise General Zia for his troops' supposedly stellar behavior. "President Mohammad Zia immediately dispatched Pakistani troops to protect our personnel and property, called to extend his personal apologies to me and to the American people, and insisted that his government would pay for all the damages," Carter later wrote in his memoirs. Americans personally involved in the ordeal had a different opinion. "Shit. They didn't do shit," U.S. Navy Commander Charles W. Monahan told a Washington Post reporter about the Pakistani government after emerging from the burning compound. Carter's praise for Zia in particular produced cold fury among the survivors. From then on, every time the Marines in Islamabad had a beer, they made a point to curse their president and commander-in-chief. Immediately after Wednesday's attack, hundreds of non-essential U.S. personnel and diplomats' dependents were evacuated from Pakistan. This put a freeze on all but the most pressing business between the two countries. The few remaining American officials relocated to an unscathed USAID compound a quarter mile from the embassy's ruins, continuing their work with grim dedication. We were still pissed, but we were professionals, is how Haggerty felt. The Pakistani government protested the evacuation as unnecessary. General Zia went on CBS TV, assuring his interviewer that there was no anti-American sentiment in Pakistan and that U.S. citizens in his country were quite safe and in good shape. As for the small incident at the embassy, he was deeply sorry. While General Zia made these tepid apologies on CBS, his government adopted a wholly different tone when addressing the Islamic world. "The stand of the Muslims in Pakistan was magnificent, historic, and unique," the Pakistani state radio boasted in its Arabic-language broadcast. "The people's emotions were moved and were uncontrollable. The people took to the streets throughout Pakistan. They believed that this aggression against the Holy of Holies truly warranted the opposition of Muslims around the world." Far from feeling regret about bloodshed at the embassy, Qaid-e-Azam student leaders pressed on with anti-American demonstrations. They considered themselves the injured party, claiming that the two rioters who died on the attack had been felled by American bullets. Student leaders at the university demanded that the Pakistani government detain and indict the U.S. ambassador, Arthur Hummel, and, instead of reimbursing Washington for damage at the embassy, force the U.S. government to pay compensation at $30,000 per dead protester. Chapter 14. While mobs rampaged in Pakistan, Saudi Crown Prince Fahd found himself that Wednesday, November 21st, in a highly uncomfortable position, under Klieg lights at the Arab summit in Tunis. Used to dispersing money and advice as he basked in the fawning of favor-seekers, the Saudi royal now had to explain to the world the embarrassing reports of trouble at home. The international journalistic contingent that gathered in Tunis for the summit buzzed with excitement. Everyone bayed for details on the uprising that foreign correspondents kept out by Saudi Arabia's draconian visa policies were not allowed to witness firsthand. While Fahd didn't deign meeting the lowly newsmen and women in person, his Saudi aides made a valiant attempt to quash the entire story. Statements coming out of Washington were ill-informed exaggeration, they assured. In any case, total calm had now been restored to Mecca. The violence in the Grand Mosque, dismissed by one Saudi spokesman in Tunis as a domestic incident, was pronounced over. Fellow Arab leaders, well versed in the art of lying, didn't believe a word of these denials. Early Wednesday morning, they surrounded Fahd at an informal closed-doors briefing, peppering the Saudi with pointed questions. Then, in a purported show of sympathy, tinged by political calculations about how the summit's resolutions might be affected by a Saudi absence, they advised the Crown Prince to head home. "The brothers, leaders of the Arab countries, told me that there was nothing at the conference that required my presence," Fahd recalled later. "But I realized that by remaining there I would prove the fallaciousness of the speculations. The atmosphere was filled with rumors. What would have been the situation had I gone back immediately?" So Fahd stayed put, flashing a smile whenever he happened within sight of the cameras. His manner was persuasive. Jordan's King Hussein relayed to his own crown prince that day just how, very calmly, Fahd seemed to be taking the terrible news from Mecca. For 2 more days, Fahd was bogged down in interminable debates over Lebanon's request to bar Palestinian commandos from the southern part of that country. The plenary meeting of Arab heads of state, initially scheduled for 5 p.m. Wednesday, was postponed until 9 p.m., and then until Thursday morning. Unlike Fahd, Prince Abdullah, the commander of the National Guard, cut short his Moroccan vacation on Wednesday and headed back home. The senior princes already in Saudi Arabia, Sultan, Nayef, and the just-returned GID chief, Turki al-Faisal, were so involved in the unfolding battle for Mecca that they had no time for American diplomats. In his telegrams, Ambassador West relied mostly on official statements and the reports of Hambly's chopper pilot relative, who continued flying sorties above the holy shrine. "We had a virtual blackout of news and adequate intelligence reports," the frustrated ambassador jotted down in his diary that day. He was desperate to provide Washington with more information about events that now directly affected American interests. On Wednesday at lunchtime, he finally managed to meet Ahmed Zaki Yamani, the Saudi oil minister whose 45 relatives were among Juhayman's hostages. a native of Mecca, the U.S.-educated Sheikh Yamani, the face of Saudi Arabia during the 1970s oil crisis, was probably the best-known Saudi commoner at the time. His Van Dyke beard and enigmatic smile mesmerized oil traders worldwide. His every word was able to move markets in New York, London, or Tokyo. Though excluded from direct management of the crisis in Mecca, Yamani possessed a treasure trove of information, both through his government role and through the reports of Meccan relatives that reached him every 15 minutes by phone from observation points and houses along the Grand Mosque. Two of Yamani's relatives had now succeeded in fleeing the mosque. They were sheltered in the minister's Jeddah home. One sat in silence during the minister's conversation with Ambassador West. From Yamani, the American government heard for the first time about the existence of one Mohammed Abdullah. Ambassador West listened with awe as the Saudi minister outlined Muslim beliefs about the Mahdi. He took down copious notes about obtuse theological issues surrounding the second coming of Jesus, the false Jesus preceding the real Jesus, and the general religious significance of the first day of the Muslim new century. "The Mahdi," he wrote in his diary, "is a sort of John the Baptist type." The Saudi government already seemed to know a lot about the identity of the rebels. Yamani relayed to Ambassador West crucial pieces of information, that Mohammed Abdullah, a man of imposing appearance and personality, was a former Riyadh student in his mid-20s who had been imprisoned for 4 months for activities inimical to the government, and who had absolutely nothing to do with Iran. What would be the results of this takeover? The American ambassador wondered. Exuding calm, Yamani predicted that the uprising in Mecca would have few political repercussions. "As for the rebels themselves," he said matter-of-factly, "sooner or later they will be captured and beheaded." As Ambassador West conversed with Yamani and the American embassy burned in Islamabad, outpourings of anger at the desecration of the Kaaba began to reverberate across the Muslim world. Under pressure from Washington, on Wednesday afternoon, Prince Nayef's Interior Ministry issued a new statement that, for the first time, seemed to exculpate the Americans. "There are no indications that lead us to believe that foreign nationalities were involved in the incident," the ministry announced. "It has been confirmed that the attack has been carried out by a gang that deviated from the path of Islam." Such tepid Saudi denials failed to discredit Khomeini's conspiracy theory of American and or Israeli involvement in the Grand Mosque takeover. The Ayatollah's outlandish hypothesis continued to gain acceptance among Sunnis and Shiites alike. Syria's national radio and TV repeated the same allegations, as did the Sunni Mufti of Lebanon, Sheikh Hassad Khaled. "According to our religion, in the Mecca enclosure, not even a bird could be killed, or a tree uprooted," the Lebanese Mufti explained. "We estimate that this operation is a Zionist imperialist attempt to torpedo the Arab summit." In Egypt, the chief Sunni Muslim religious authority, Mohammed Abdelrahman Bissar, Grand Sheikh of Al-Azhar, turned his wrath in another direction. He took the Saudi ulema to task for maintaining a distressing public silence about the grave events at the shrine. In a telegram sent on Wednesday to bin Baz and other Saudi ulema, Bissar urged quick, decisive action to save the holy house of God and called on the world's most important Muslim scholars, Saudi and foreign, to meet near Mecca to determine a joint Islamic response. Between the lines of this telegram, from the most influential Sunni cleric outside Saudi Arabia, loomed a terrifying message for al-Saud and the Wahhabi establishment. Having failed to protect the Grand Mosque from brutal aggression, the Saudis were now being asked to share their lucrative monopoly over managing the sacred shrines with the rest of the Muslim world. The perpetrators of this outrage, Bissar suggested helpfully, could be put to death by crucifixion. Bin Baz was able to receive the Egyptian message because by Wednesday night, phone and telegraph links between Saudi Arabia and the rest of the world had been restored. This allowed the first independent news on the situation in the kingdom to filter out. After more than a day of frustration, James Buchan, a future British novelist then living in Jeddah and working as a stringer, a part-time correspondent, for London's Financial Times, finally managed to get his editors on the line. Though unable to visit Mecca, he pieced together information obtained from Western diplomats and Saudi eyewitnesses. Once Buchan started dictating the dispatch, an angry Saudi operator cut in, disconnecting the line.
"Mecca, la!" he shouted. "Mecca, no!"
Buchan still got into print crucial pieces of the puzzle, that the rebels were somehow associated with Juhayman's Utebi tribe, that they did not appear to be linked with Khomeini, and that the fighting so far had caused several dozen, possibly several hundred, deaths. These nuggets of truth drowned in the wild speculation the information blackout had provoked around the world. The Grand Mosque's Imam, Ibn Subayl, current Mecca Governor Prince Fawaz, former Mecca Governor Prince Mishal, and other senior members of the House of Saud were erroneously reported dead. Lebanon's former President Camille Chamoun, who suggested in these chaotic hours that the Mecca uprising had been inspired by his enemy, Syria, made the ultimate faux pas of issuing public condolences. "Prince Mishal," Chamoun announced solemnly, "was a friend of Lebanon and a personal friend." This declaration wasn't the only episode of comic relief. Taking literally the Saudi designation of Juhayman's group as Kharijites, the French news agency reported that the attackers inside the Grand Mosque belonged to the 600,000-strong Kharijite Muslim sect, generally considered fanatical and mainly represented in Tunisia, Algeria, Oman, and Tanzania. Sami Angawi, the director of the Hajj Research Center in Jeddah, was determined to find out for himself the identity of the mysterious deviators in the Grand Mosque. If the Mahdi had really appeared, this was an event of planetary importance, he thought after leaving the office of the water and sewage director. And, as a direct descendant of the Prophet, Angawi felt that he was duty-bound to be present in Mecca for the historic occasion. Clearing several rings of checkpoints that now slowed to a grind all traffic in and out of the city, Angawi returned to his hometown. There, he called on Islamic luminaries among Mecca's prominent families. Shunning established Wahhabi ulema who had been imported by al-Saud from the Najd, he sought advice from fellow Sufi sheikhs and from other elders of Mecca's own more tolerant tradition of Islam. Many of them had been inside the Grand Mosque the previous morning, and they held nothing but scorn for Juhayman and the alleged Mahdi. A true Mahdi wouldn't have to discharge firearms, attack worshippers, and lock the mosque's gates, these scholars noted with distaste. The rebels' uncouth speech, one turbaned elder mused, was all too similar to the pronouncements that the dreaded Ikhwan had been making in Mecca 5 decades earlier. "Same Wahhabis, same talk," he scoffed. "Same thing." This was a consensus that coalesced in Mecca by the second day of the crisis. Juhayman's austere, violent movement may have appealed to many in the Wahhabi heartland of the Najd, but here in Mecca, a cosmopolitan city whose residents hailed from the four corners of the world and often resented Wahhabi domination, it elicited little sympathy. Whatever grudges Meccans still held about being subjects of al-Saud, they saw these wild, bearded rebels who now held their sacred shrine hostage as a far worse evil. Spontaneously, many locals offered food and shelter to the Saudi troops that started to converge on the city. After much reflection, Angawi, too, came to the conclusion that he must assist the government in liberating the mosque. He had something to offer. As head of the Hajj Research Center, Angawi had conducted detailed studies of the Grand Mosque compound. He possessed floor plans and large sheets of aerial photography. In his professional capacity, Angawi also dealt with Prince Ahmed, the king's brother and deputy minister of the interior. He called the prince's office and asked whether these documents might be of use. "Yes, come quickly, quickly," the prince's secretary shouted into the phone. It wasn't clear, though, where the prince was located. Angawi rolled the maps and aerial photographs into a long tube and headed toward the Grand Mosque. Talking his way past checkpoints, he suddenly found himself by one of the main gates of the enclosure. A handful of soldiers crouched in the area, taking cover from snipers on the minarets. They were shocked to see Angawi and his tube of maps, the container so similar to a bazooka from a distance, in the middle of the battlefield. Their commanding officer was visibly upset. "You are crazy!" he shouted at Angawi. "What are you doing here?" Prince Ahmed, the officer said, was to be found in the Shubra Hotel, the same one where Princes Nayef and Sultan, the ministers of Interior and Defense, had arrived the previous day.
To get there, Angawi had to cross the plaza. He finally realized that he was risking his life and that the documents tube in his hands made him a likely target for snipers. He was told to tie up his robe and to make zigzags as he ran toward safety. The Shubra by now had turned into a veritable military outpost. Fearing an attack on the hotel's illustrious guests, security forces strung up a booby-trapped tripwire at the entrance. The senior princes and military men were planning the first serious raid of the mosque and were too busy to meet with Angawi. Instead, an aide was dispatched downstairs to meet the academic. Angawi handed him the maps and the photographs and outlined possible ways of organizing the assault. Abhorring the idea of deploying tanks or artillery on the holy ground, Angawi proposed using bulldozers. These, he said, could knock down gates and protect infantry soldiers entering the enclosure. Photos and maps brought in by Angawi were snapped up by commanders desperate for hard information about their target. Major Nafai of the Special Security Forces, who was entrusted with drawing up the operations plan for the impending assault, had been expecting some help on this front from Osama bin Laden's older brother, Salem. Salem had taken over the bin Laden family's helm after his father's death in a 1967 air crash, and, together with the bin Laden business empire, inherited close ties to the royal household. The bin Laden company, which built or renovated almost all the structures around the Kaaba, was the only one to possess detailed blueprints of the shrine. Salem rushed to the Mecca war room right after hearing about Juhayman's intrusion. But he didn't bring these precious blueprints along, and, military officers remarked with scorn, seemed mostly preoccupied with ingratiating himself with the royals. The company was in the middle of moving offices, Salem explained, and it was very difficult to locate the exact boxes that contained these documents. This meant that until Angawi's documents arrived, Major Nafai and fellow planners had to grope in the dark. Nobody told them about the existence of the intricate labyrinth, the Kabu, in the basement under the mosque. Intelligence about the number of gunmen inside and about their weaponry was also scarce. Valuable information could have been gleaned from pilgrims who still continued escaping from the shrine, but most of these were immediately snatched by Mabahath secret police agents and bundled away for political interrogations in Jeddah or Riyadh, before military intelligence officers had a chance to ask vital questions about the battlefield. No new reports arrived from the several members of the unarmed police service still holed up inside the Grand Mosque. These men, whom the Imam Ibn Subayl had tried to rouse for action in the first hours of the crisis, remained trapped in their station inside the compound and were in touch via phone after the cleric escaped on Tuesday. The following day, they were discovered. Juhayman's rebels promptly manacled the policemen with metal cuffs taken from the station's cupboards and locked them up in a holding cell in the basement. The duty officer, who had been prudent enough to take off the top of his uniform, managed to pass for a simple trooper and wasn't maltreated. As Saudi officials discussed their options on Wednesday, some of the royals, remembering displays of paratrooper prowess they had watched at military maneuvers, proposed dropping airborne commandos into the shrine. It took a while for Major Nafai and other military men to deflect this idea. He explained that paratroopers landing into such a confined space would be riddled with bullets before they even reached the ground, and that their choppers would be quite likely shot out of the air. These arguments were illustrated by the frequent fusillades that the rebels had already unleashed on Saudi aircraft. On almost every sortie, Dan's Chinook was shot at by what appeared to be a 50-caliber machine gun placed among the twin minarets. Tracer rounds soared into the sky from several other emplacements. One round narrowly missed the American-piloted chopper, burning out at about 8,000 feet, or more than twice its altitude. Even crews of Saudi F-5 fighter jets, which regularly overflew the shrine, now feared being shot down and adopted a relatively safe flat flight pattern. Nobody wanted to lose costly aircraft. The senior princes agreed. The operation to recapture the mosque would be carried out from the ground. By late Wednesday, the plans for the attack were finalized. The House of Saud wanted quick action, and so the shrine had to be liberated without waiting for additional troops. There were also complex considerations of Byzantine family politics to be accommodated, at the expense of basic military science. Every senior prince desired a share of the glory. This meant that Prince Nayef's Interior Ministry Special Security Commandos,
Prince Sultan's Saudi army, and Prince Abdullah's National Guard all had to participate in the assault, even though the three forces never trained together and didn't even have compatible radios. In a reflection of royal hubris, this hodgepodge attack team lacked armor and, numbering just several hundred men, was not much larger in size than Juhayman's force of well-entrenched zealots. Unwilling to consider Juhayman's rebels a serious threat, the royal family at the time still regarded the trouble at the Grand Mosque as a law enforcement issue. This meant that Prince Nayef's interior ministry, rather than the regular military, took charge of the joint force. Major General Mohammed bin Hilal, chief of the Riyadh Region Police and head of the Special Security, became its commander. Stuck between the two sides once the battle lines were drawn, several pilgrims spent these harrowing hours cloistered in the Africa Hotel, the windows of which overlooked the sacred enclosure. All the shops in the area had long closed, and the deserted streets were patrolled by the troops, some of whom were already making unauthorized withdrawals from the nearby gold market. The hotel's mostly foreign guests were afraid to venture out into frequent crossfire and stayed hungry throughout the day. One of these inhabitants of the Africa Hotel was Abdelazim al-Mattani, an Egyptian professor of Arabic who had prayed by the Kaaba at the time of Juhayman's takeover, separated by just one row of men from the Imam Ibn Subayl, who managed to flee the Grand Mosque in the first hour of the siege. Once a journalist for an Egyptian newspaper, Mattani realized that he had become a rare eyewitness to history with a panoramic view of the battlefield. His tiny room did not have a desk, so placing an attaché case on his lap, he began taking notes on the momentous developments just across the street from his hotel. Through most of Wednesday, he noted, fighting was very light. But late at night, Mattani was awoken by terrifying flashes and the sound of explosions. The hotel's building shook, window panes started to break, and Mattani jumped from his bed. Saudi artillery, deployed on hills overlooking the city, had just started shelling the mosque. Chapter 15. Concerned with the ulama's sensibilities and still lacking a formal fatwa from the learned clerics, the Saudi government was very careful not to damage the Grand Mosque in the initial attack. The shells that started to rain on the sacred compound were mostly flashbang charges that did not produce lethal fragments. These fireworks were supposed to disorient Juhayman's men with deafening noise and a blinding, brilliant light. Once the shelling began, at about 3:30 a.m., groups of ground commandos raced toward the gates of the enclosure. Major Suleiman al-Shaman led a unit of 30 men to the eastern side of the Marwa Safa Gallery. This two-story arcade, stretching some 450 meters, about 490 yards, in length, replicates the route that the biblical Hagar had followed as she searched for water for her son Ishmael. Running south toward the main body of the mosque, the Marwa Safa Gallery, lined with carpets, tiled with precious marble, and lit with gilded chandeliers, was a key part of the pilgrimage ritual and contained 11 gates on its sides. Hoping to take advantage of the confusion, Major Shaman's men aimed to break through the Bab al-Salam, or the Peace Gate, at the midpoint in the gallery and seize a foothold for the next wave of troops. Nobody knew for sure exactly how many militants were holed up inside. Officers had been told about dozens, not hundreds. Very soon it became obvious that all this cacophony of explosions and flashes of light didn't much impress Juhayman's men. Their training in National Guard camps in the desert was paying off. Rebel snipers atop the minarets instantly spotted advancing government soldiers and unloaded volleys of fire on them. Major Shaman's troops, like the unlucky police team on the first day of the standoff, found themselves in a killing field. Bullets cracked the marble around the unit, sending into the air little fountains of chipped stone and dust. Fire no longer came just from the minarets. Gunmen also opened fire from top-floor windows of the mosque itself. Soldiers desperately sought cover, but the massive gate wouldn't give in, and there was nowhere to hide. Then, suddenly, one of the halves of the gate was pulled from inside, just enough to allow rebel guns to unload at the soldiers point-blank from the pitch-black darkness beyond. With a thud, one of the officers in the unit, a captain, fell dead. Minutes later, a corporal was riddled by high-velocity lead. and then a mist of pink spray burst from Major Shaman's face. His khaki uniform turning carmine from spurting blood, the Major slumped and then also tumbled to the ground. Within minutes of starting, this offensive unraveled at the Peace Gate, as it did at other approaches to the mosque. With senior officers out of commission, the remaining soldiers did what anyone would in such a meat grinder. They crammed their bodies behind any semblance of cover, focused on staying alive. Some glued themselves to the wall behind curves that obscured the rebels' line of fire. Others curled up in crevices of the structure. One of Major Shaman's men, Staff Sergeant Mohammed Ayed, had been hit in the knee. Bleeding, he and a fellow soldier sat in a blind spot, waiting for a lull in the fighting and praying for deliverance. An hour later, searchlights belatedly illuminated the minarets, denying rebel snipers the cover of darkness. The smoke had cleared. The guns had been silent for a while. It seemed like the right moment to try and escape. The first line of houses that could offer refuge from this carnage seemed tantalizingly close. Juhayman's snipers, many of them expert hunters, patiently waited for just this moment. Once the two bedraggled survivors started to move, they squeezed the triggers. Another bullet tore through Ayed's thigh. Fire once again seemed to erupt from every direction. Crawling back, Ayed saw that what had been Major Shaman was now a messy pulp of charred flesh. One of the latest rebel volleys had hit an explosive or a grenade that had been attached to the Major's belt. The munition went off in a radiant ball of fire, shredding the officer's torso. Dazed, Ayed abandoned whatever remained of the killed Major and managed to pull himself into a nearby hideout next to a surviving comrade. There he remained, holding his leg and attempting to stanch the blood loss, for 12 hours. The two had no food, no medication, and no way of communicating with the outside world. Fellow soldiers seemed in no haste to rescue them. At the end, it was only Juhayman's reluctance to shoot at civilians that saved the men's lives. Though Ayed and his comrade were not visible to rebels inside the mosque, they sat in plain sight of ordinary Meccans who lived across the street from the Peace Gate. During a pause in the fighting, three of these neighbors dared to venture outdoors. They took pity on the wounded troops and brought out some of their own clothes. Once the injured soldiers donned these robes, pretending to be ordinary civilians, the three neighbors returned with a stretcher. An ambulance was parked behind a nearby house, safely outside the rebel line of fire, ready to take the men to the hospital. In Ayed's recollection, a total of 6 members of his massacred unit had been saved this way. The Grand Mosque remained firmly in Juhayman's hands. Conspirators inside celebrated with prayers. Because of God's protection afforded to the faithful, the Saudi army, while not quite swallowed into the ground, had been unable to harm the Mahdi's defenders. From the minarets, rebel snipers surveyed a landscape of soot-coated body parts, burned shells, and pockmarked marble that emerged from under acrid smoke. Though disturbed by the rebels' battlefield prowess, the House of Saud was in no mood to let up. The senior prince's war council decided to press on with the offensive, sending into the Grand Mosque's death trap freshly arrived rangers of the Saudi Army's 6th Paratroop Battalion. The battalion, normally based in the northern city of Tabuk, was commanded by Colonel Nasser al-Humeid. Many of his rangers had been trained in France, and unlike National Guard troops, they were itching for action, unhindered by the lack of a fatwa from the clerics. One of these French-trained officers, a 28-year-old captain who went by the name Abu Sultan, felt a personal injury from Juhayman's outrage. In the times before al-Sa'd's conquest of the Holy City, Abu Sultan's grandfather had served as chief of the Grand Mosque Police. A wiry, intense man with a cropped mustache, Captain Abu Sultan spent the first hours of the uprising frantically dialing Meccan acquaintances, collecting every tidbit of news from the shrine. On Wednesday, the second day of the standoff, his battalion was called up on alert, and following the late morning prayer, headed on to C-130 transport planes. Abu Sultan was the first aircraft arriving in the Grand Mosque's vicinity by the afternoon. Soldiers already on the ground welcomed the newcomers with awed advice. The Grand Mosque rebels, they noted, shot well, and whenever a trigger was pulled on one of the minarets, a uniformed man was usually felled. The Tabuk Rangers' mission, like that of the late Major Shaman's unit, was to penetrate the opulent gallery that enclosed the path between Marwa and Safa Hills. Major Shaman's men had been bludgeoned as they tried to enter the peace gate on the eastern side of that gallery. The 6th Battalion would try a different route, breaking into the structure from its northernmost tip at Marwa, and then proceeding southward, paying special attention to dangers that lurked around the ill-fated peace gate. As Colonel Homaid outlined this action plan early Thursday morning, one senior prince, most likely Prince Nayef, listened impatiently and then demanded an immediate attack. The colonel, aware of the horrendous casualty rate among the other units attempting to storm the Grand Mosque, suggested that it would be better to wait for the night. Blinded by the floodlights, he argued, the rebels might not be able to see the attack force. Prince Nayef, a portly mercurial man used to unquestioning obedience, exploded with fury. By one account, he yelled at Colonel Homaid, "You are not a man!" and dismissed the officer's objections as a show of cowardice. Loss of life was not important, the prince declared. In such a noble mission, soldiers killed in battle would be considered martyrs for Islam and win for themselves a ticket to paradise. Humbled, Colonel Homaid could only salute and order an immediate attack. 6th Battalion Rangers managed to sneak undetected by the Marwa Gate, and they affixed TNT charges on its perimeter, running a wire from the detonator to the nearest army outpost. On Abu Sultan's signal, the explosives went off, blowing the massive gate off its hinges. The gate, so heavy that some 50 troopers would be unable to make it budge in following days, fell flat on the ground, dispersing a cloud of dust, ash, and stone fragments. To prove his courage, Colonel Homaid stepped first into the opening, followed by the battalion's S-3 operations officer, Major Turki al-Usaimi. Behind them advanced a few dozen men, most of them from a platoon commanded by Lieutenant Abdulaziz Kadabi. Amid choking smoke inside the gallery, everything seemed unnaturally quiet. Shoes, prayer books, shawls, and bags left by escaping worshippers littered the ground. Not a single rebel was in sight. Not a gunshot could be heard. The unit moved ahead step by step, fingers on the trigger. The gallery, a multi-lane pedestrian highway that left the unit exposed in its large empty bowels, contained plenty of hideouts. There, Juhayman's men waited patiently for just the right moment to strike. Muhammad Abdullah, the supposed Mahdi himself, was among dozens of conspirators who lurked in this passageway. His chest crossed in the shape of an X by two bandoliers packed with bullets, he trained the sights of his rifle on the advancing troopers. So did Faisal Muhammad Faisal, one of Juhayman's most senior commanders. By the time the paratroopers realized they were in an ambush, it was too late. The soldiers were almost halfway into the gallery when rebels popped up four at a time from the windows on the sides and from raised platforms, unleashing a hailstorm of lead. Colonel Homaid was killed by the first volley. Seconds later, his deputy, Major Usaimi, fell on the ground, wounded in the leg. As he tried to press with the offensive and rescue the two senior officers, the mustachioed, baby-faced Lieutenant Kadabi felt a rebel bullet graze his arm. Seeking cover behind columns and crawling on the ground, he and the few surviving members of the decimated assault team radioed for help from the outside. It took hours for the rescue party to arrive, and it too came under heavy fire as soon as it penetrated the gallery. Shell-shocked, these reinforcements were too scared to approach Major Usaimi, who now lay in a puddle of his own blood. Instead, they threw him a rope and yelled, "Hold on!" Clenching his teeth, the major grabbed the rope, and the rescuers started to pull. As soon as Major Usaimi was yanked out of his hideout and onto a stretch of open floor, a new salvo burrowed into his body. Slammed by bullets, his body jerked for a second or two, and then went unnaturally limp. He was now obviously dead. Lieutenant Kadabi, meanwhile, tried to keep moving forward. He didn't get far before a second bullet skewered his forearm, tearing apart a muscle and causing blood to squirt out. Minutes later, as the young lieutenant lost consciousness, he was hit once again by a spray of bird pellets shot from a hunting rifle. When Lieutenant Kadabi reopened his eyes, the offensive had fallen apart and the gallery was filled with the moans of the dying. As in a dream, he saw two bearded gunmen standing above him. They pulled him up and carted him away to a room on the upper level of the mosque. The lieutenant's vision was blurred, and he no longer felt his arm. Inside the dark room, Lieutenant Kudavy noticed another soldier from his unit by the wall. The second prisoner, injured in the same engagement, struggled with a nasty chest wound. There were no medics among the rebels. Still, one of the gunmen tried to help. He brought a piece of cloth soaked in holy Zamzam water, the closest thing to disinfectant available in the shrine, and tightly bandaged it around Lieutenant Kadavi's forearm. According to the Hadith, he explained, Zamzam water was the best cure for all ailments. Once the militants slowed the blood loss, they tried to convert the two prisoners to Jahiman's cause. They earnestly explained to their captives that the Mahdi had come, and that television, radio, khaki uniforms, and salaries paid by the Ministry of Defense were all deemed haram, prohibited by the Almighty. Chapter 16. The world did not know about this bloodbath. As the surviving soldiers trickled out of the Grand Mosque neighborhood, leaving dead and severely injured comrades behind, the Saudi government decided to announce a victory. At 11 a.m. on Thursday, November 22nd, state-run Riyadh radio broadcast a long speech by the information minister, Mohammed Abdul Yamani. These were the first official comments on the Mecca crisis since the two terse interior ministry statements the previous day. The information minister, theoretically in charge of determining what the country's newspapers could and couldn't write, did not have much actual power. A relative liberal, he, like the oil minister Ahmed Zaki Yamani, hailed from a Meccan family of Yemeni origin and didn't possess the tribal clout of a Nejdi bloodline, let alone the authority that royal descent could confer. In sensitive matters, and few were as sensitive as the one now at hand, he took his cue from senior royals, especially Prince Nayef. The royal policy was simple. Save face and insist that all is well. Defeat is victory. Ignorance is strength. Matters, thanks be to God, are now under total control, Yamani proclaimed with a sigh of relief on the radio this Thursday morning, shortly after Colonel Homaid was killed and the platoon commander taken hostage. This group, which is deviating from the Islamic religion, is under the control of security authorities. Like other Saudi officials, Yamani was defensive. He felt the need to explain why this minor incident had taken so long to bring under total control. Juhayman's rebels, Yamani assured, could have been ousted by force at any moment, but the competent security authorities were anxious to handle this matter with all the wisdom and with consideration for the lives of Muslims inside the Holy Mosque, who are innocent and helpless in this matter. Then, contradicting everything he had said so far, the minister indicated that the total control was not yet quite totally total. The state will continue tackling this issue in order to end it, God willing, in the next few hours. This nuance went unnoticed by foreign leaders dependent on Saudi largesse and eager to help al-Saud maintain the fiction of having resolved the crisis. They rushed to fire off congratulatory telegrams to Riyadh. We have learned with a deep sense of relief and thanksgiving that by the grace of Almighty Allah, Your Majesty's forces have been able to clear the holy precincts from the benighted elements, the Pakistani President Zia wrote King Khalid that Thursday. The devotees of Islam, who are once again free to offer worship in the Grand Mosque, owe to Your Majesty a debt of gratitude. The Saudi announcement of victory was also taken at face value by the Riyadh-based U.S. military training mission, which coordinated American defense cooperation with the kingdom. Citing its contacts in the Saudi Ministry of Defense, USMTM quickly reported that Saudi forces gained entry to the first floor of the mosque by means of their M113 armored personnel carriers, which provided adequate cover against the occupiers' fire. Dan, the American Chinook pilot debriefed the same day by Hambley and Ryer, provided a completely different assessment. Once the assault on the Marwa Safa gallery withered, he said, the pilots could see no activity whatsoever, either in the mosque or in the surrounding area, which continued to be cordoned off for a 3-to-5-block area. No APCs or track traces could be sighted in the area. On the way back to Jeddah on Thursday afternoon, his chopper carried some 15 wounded soldiers from the 6th Paratroop Battalion. Judging from direct observations, Dan reported, it was implausible that Saudi forces had managed to seize any part of the mosque. In composing his Thursday cable to Washington, A perplexed Ambassador West was at a loss over whom to believe. "We have no explanation for the inconsistency between the pilot's observations and the various reports we have received regarding the alleged slow but methodical recapture of the mosque from Islamic dissidents," he wrote. It was highly frustrating that nobody from the embassy had been able to look at the battlefield with his own eyes. Something had to be done. Abroad, as the continuing absence of reliable news spurred rumor-mongering, the Mecca affair took on a life of its own. For the U.S. government, the crisis's main repercussion so far was the lethal attack on the American diplomats in Pakistan. State Department officials were shocked by the intensity of anti-American feelings there, and the ease with which the wildest accusations against the United States seemed to be believed nowadays. Brzezinski's advice to Carter earlier that year now seemed patently wrong. The Iranian Revolution was not isolated. The fervent anti-American propaganda coming out of Tehran was making Muslims worldwide see America as the enemy of their faith. That Thursday, demonstrators, infuriated by the mayhem in Mecca, stoned the residents of the U.S. consul in Izmir, Turkey, and attempted to storm the building. The same happened in the Bangladeshi capital, Dhaka, where Islamist protesters, held at bay by police, tried to burn down the American embassy. In Pakistan, as the evacuation of U.S. personnel continued, schools and bazaars remained closed for the second day in a row. Secretary of State Vance and other U.S. officials grew increasingly concerned that Wednesday's Saudi denial of involvement by foreign nationalities in the Mecca uprising just wasn't explicit enough to quash conspiracy theories propagated by Tehran. So Thursday morning, Vance set in motion a crescendo of diplomatic activity. In Jeddah, Ambassador West once again called on the oil minister, Ahmed Zaki Yamani. Reading aloud Khomeini's statement, West explained to Yamani that Iranian accusations were putting in jeopardy the lives of American citizens as well as American diplomats throughout the Islamic world, and that the United States felt it had the right to demand a stronger refutation. Examining the previous day's Interior Ministry statement, Yamani agreed with Ambassador West that the text might indeed be insufficient. He explained that the Saudis were concerned that a more explicit denial of foreign involvement in the uprising might be construed as speculative if it came before the mosque was liberated and an investigation of the affair was completed. America wasn't prepared to wait so long. Surely, Ambassador West retorted, the Saudi government knew even without an investigation that Washington had nothing to do with the Mecca events? Impressed by the vigor of American protests, Yamani promised to take up the matter directly with Prince Sultan in the afternoon. At the Arab summit in Tunis, meanwhile, American diplomats sought out the Saudi delegation and passed an urgent personal message from Vance to the Saudi foreign minister, Prince Saud al-Faisal. It was a matter of great importance, Vance wrote sternly, that the Saudis make an unequivocal statement on the crisis in Mecca, dealing with the allegations that Americans engineered this behind the scenes. A few hours later, Saud al-Faisal discussed the request with Crown Prince Fahd and wrote back, promising action. The Saudi Arabian government has the deepest faith in the non-existence of any relationship of the U.S. to the incident under discussion. Speaking in unison with the Great Satan, revolutionaries in Tehran were making similar demands. They requested that the Saudis rule out any suggestion of their involvement in the Mecca uprising. Early Thursday afternoon, Prince Nayef obliged, finally releasing a new declaration that pleased everyone. Neither the United States, Iran, or any other countries have had anything to do with the attack on the Holy Kaaba, he announced. News reports alleging U.S. involvement in the incident were absolutely untrue and baseless. There is a reason it took so long for Saudi officials, and especially the conspiratorial-minded Prince Nayef, to clear up the blood libel against their American ally. In their heart of hearts, Saudi royals just couldn't forgive Washington for leaking the news of a disturbance in Mecca on the first day of the crisis. This PR blunder caused al-Saud a humiliating loss of face, just as the kingdom was expecting to revel in its oil-fueled influence at the summit in Tunis. For years to come, opponents of the Saudi regime held up this disclosure by Washington as proof positive of the royal family's subservience to the United States. Prince Nayef himself outlined his frustrations in an interview with a Lebanese newspaper a few weeks later. The Americans, he complained, had publicized the incident in Mecca so quickly that it seemed that they had known about it in advance. Such inexplicable haste, in the prince's opinion, justified anti-American violence. "We have the right to speculate about the reason why the Americans announced the report the way they did," he pronounced. "Thus, we understand why the demonstrations that were staged in several Islamic cities against the U.S. embassies and other symbols of U.S. presence took place, for everyone thought the United States was associated with this issue." Nayef's explicit denial of U.S. involvement in the Mecca affair, extracted by such an intense diplomatic effort, failed to impress Tehran's revolutionary propagandists. The Iranian media and pro-Iranian radicals worldwide kept up denunciations of a criminal deed perpetrated by gangs of Zionists and imperialists, and masterminded by U.S. intelligence. Khomeini personally notched up the rhetoric on Thursday evening as he welcomed in the Iranian holy city of Qom a delegation of some 120 senior Pakistani military officers who transited Iran on their way home from the Hajj in Mecca. In this televised encounter, Khomeini warmly praised the Pakistanis for the previous day's destruction of the American embassy in Islamabad. "It is a cause for joy that all Pakistan has risen against the United States," the Ayatollah told the politely listening Pakistani officers. "All Muslim armies and law enforcement agencies," Khomeini continued, "should now join Iran in this battle, for the confrontation was not between America and Iran, but between the entire world of disbelief and the world of Islam." Victory was close, the Ayatollah assured, because America's own society was about to implode. "There is, in fact, discord and disunity among blacks in America, who have been oppressed by the United States, and who are now behind us and supporting us," Khomeini explained. "It is possible that they may start an uprising, too." The Pakistani officers, many of whom had graduated from Western military academies, seemed swayed by the Ayatollah's intoxicating words. "Inshallah, God willing," they shouted at the end of Khomeini's speech. "May God give strength to Muslim armies," Khomeini cried. "Amen," the officers roared back.